is ready. Michelle is ready.
Michelle is as ready as she's going to get.
And it's okay if we take these out of order?
Yeah.
Okay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With apologies for the delay, we had a full committee in here, and by the time the room gets rearranged, we're a little bit behind schedule. But with that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for June 28th, 2017. We are gathered today for the purpose of public hearings and work sessions on a number of bills. I am going to exercise the prerogative of the chair to take these slightly out of order because we have colleagues here that wish to testify, and undoubtedly their presence is needed someplace else. Because Representative McLean has two bills, I believe, that you're testifying on, I would open now a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2742 and House Bill 2741 and invite Representative McLean forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These colleagues, I represent District 55 in the House. These two bills are continuing a program called the Wildfire Housing Relief Program. It's Wildfire Damage Housing Relief Account, and puts money into the account. I believe, Madam Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, you have an alternative amount put in there than what was requested. But bottom line is, this is designed to set up to get relief to those homeowners who lose their homes in a wildfire. I won't delay with the heart-wrenching stories that led to us creating this account. And the stories of people who have found it very difficult to navigate the administration of this account. But we believe the agency has got it and understands that the legislature is asking them to dispense funds quickly to people who are uninsured or underinsured and lose a home in a wildfire. I can answer any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Colleagues, any questions of Representative McLean? Representative McLean, your last comment, I'm very sympathetic to these, and having worked in my old professional life fighting fire from helicopters, I know the devastating effect of conflagration. Also packed a house twice when you could see the flames. So I'm well aware of how important these are. But when you said uninsured or underinsured, if I just choose not to have insurance, roll the dice, and my house gets burned down, am I eligible to apply?
Madam Chair, there is an income criteria, and if you have insurance that so you are not in need, or the deductible so high that you can't clear the ground to restart, then I believe you would be applicable. But the origin of this came from folks who did not have insurance or were underinsured on homes that were basically single wide. And what we found in a devastating fire on a very impoverished community in Klamath County was that folks didn't have money to even pay for county permits to restart or to even clear the ground. So there were all sorts of justifications to basically getting folks in a very small amount. I believe it was $5,000. This would up it to $7,000 for the purposes of getting them to paying a subcontractor to clear the ground to restart, or to paying for the permits to restart. When people didn't even have that amount of cash, the inability to transition from, in essence, devastation to regrowth was delayed, and it caused all sorts of collateral issues, as well as the humanity issues.
Thank you very much. And if I understood you correctly, each applicant is capped at $7,000.
Yes, Madam Chair, it'll be they are capped. This is not a big amount, but it's designed to get people cash quickly following the fire so that they can quickly hire contractors, put down deposits, pay permits so that they can transition and clean up their property and try to recover. What we do find is a lot of folks in rural areas that are being hit by these wildfires, at least in the last 7-8 years, are elderly, and they're single-wide mobile homes. They don't have a lot of cash, and so what we're trying to assist in that sort of transition. If somebody has insurance, and so they don't need the money, or they're a high-income individual, then they're not applicable for the program.
One last question. Are they triaged by need, or is it first come, first serve?
Triaged by need.
Thank you. Colleagues, any other questions of Representative McClain? All right. I have, is that your testimony on both bills?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So I think we'll do this separately. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2742 relating to wildfire damage housing relief account. Ask Ms. Deister to speak from the professional staff's perspective.
All right. House Bill 2742 is the portion of the changes that Representative McClain was discussing. This makes changes to the income limitations for receipt of financial assistance from the Wildfire Damage Housing Relief Account. In current law, there is a limitation on income of 75% of federal poverty guidelines, and this increases it to 200%. And the bill also changes the maximum amount of the grant that can be awarded by the Housing and Community Services Department from $5,000 to $7,000. There are no amendments associated.
Thank you very much. As a courtesy, I see housing here. Any comments on this bill? Okay, thank you. All right. Colleagues, you have heard the LFO recommendation. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I move House Bill 2742A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
You all have heard the motion. Are there any questions, any discussion, any objections? So ordered. And we need carriers. Representative McClain, I see volunteering for the House floor.
I'll do the Senate.
And Senator Hansel volunteers for full and the Senate.
Well,
Would Representative McClain like
sorry,
to take that
McClain,
to full?
Oh, yeah, you can do that.
I am on the full.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to do it.
I'm sorry.
No.
All right.
Okay.
So we've got that straightened up. My apologies, sir. All right. So now I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2741. Turn to Ms. Deister.
Okay. So this is, you have a dash one amendment to House Bill 2741. This also relates to the Wildfire Damage Housing Relief Account. The dash one amendment appropriates $150,000 general fund to the account for the 17-19 biennium.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions of Ms. Deister? And you've made your recommendation. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I move adoption of the dash one amendments to House Bill 2741.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Any questions, any discussion, any objection? So ordered.
And Co-Chair, if I then would move House Bill 2741 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Any questions, any discussion, any objection? So ordered, and I think we'll stick with the same carrier slate.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. All right, I am going to close the work session on House Bill 2741, and I am going to open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 316A relating to the Oregon Wine Board. Ask Ms. Deister to introduce us to the subject and invite our colleague and friend, Senator Winters, forward.
Okay.
And Erica, you're getting the sign-in sheet. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 316A provides funding for the Oregon Wine Board to enhance wine industry promotional programs. There is a dash A4 amendment that provides one-time support for the effort in the amount of $500,000 general fund. In addition, there is a sunset provision that's included for the enhancement program that's established by the bill.
Welcome, Senator Winters.
Thank you, Co-Chair Senator Johnson, and thank you for hearing Senate Bill 316. And I hope you'll pass it to the full Ways and Means Committee. This bipartisan bill, with support from members of both chambers, and thank you, Representative Gomberg, for being one of the co-sponsors. I've always been immensely proud of our Oregon wine industry, with some of our best wineries and vineyards in my legislative district. I've heard about the challenges that face Oregon wineries in trying to get their premium wines to customers in Oregon, throughout the United States, and around the world. And even though we're making a quality product, it is disheartening to know that Oregon wines only have a 1.5% market share of U.S. wine sold in the U.S. Retail market versus 90% wines for California. In fact, even the state of Oregon, more California, Washington wines are imported versus Oregon wines. And actually taking a look at the industries and looking at the resources that are being provided both in the state of Washington and California, I believe we need to be more creative and have new programs that help open up new markets for Oregon wineries, especially our smaller ones. This bill is about jobs and keeping the jobs now in Oregon's wine industry and growing more jobs. We have grown, and I can still remember when in Oregon there was a doubtful that we'd even have a wine industry, and the critics were saying we couldn't grow wines in Oregon. That's not true today. But if we want to continue to thrive, I think we as policymakers must assist the industry with tools that will allow them to compete nationally and globally. And so it's my hope that with the investment of this legislative session, the 500, it'll help us with both research and marketing so that we can actually increase our market share. And I would encourage you and ask you to actually to pass this bill to full Ways and Means. Those of you who, I think most of us have wineries in our districts, and some of our wineries are very, very small. And it's so small wineries that, you know, do not have often the dollars with which to do the type of marketing that will allow us to be a part of the bigger market. So I encourage your support for Senate Bill 316.
Thank you very much, colleagues. Any questions of Senator Winters? Thank you, Senator. We have three other people signed up. Mr. Danowski, Ms. McCammy, and Ms. Squires.
And Chair Johnson, and with your indulgence, since I have another assignment that I need to go to, if you will call the others up, I will leave it in their able hands if you have any further questions.
Thank you very much, Senator. All right, Mr. Danowski, Ms. McCammy, and Ms. Squires.
Well, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Gomberg and members of this committee. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 316, and I can't also thank Senator Winters enough for that really hearty endorsement of our industry and the piece of legislation that we're talking about today. Senate Bill 316, the Oregon Wine Market Access and Research Investment Strategy, is a priority for the Oregon Wine Growers Association this session. That is an association that represents
our... Would you excuse me, please? I need you to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Co-Chair. My name is Tom Danowski. I'm the Chief Executive of the Oregon Wine Growers Association and President of the Oregon Wine Board. Thank you. The reason for our bill and our proposal is quite simple. The Oregon wine industry, it is at a really unique and critical inflection point right now. As you just heard, we're generating jobs around the state. 17,000 jobs are attributable to this industry. 7,000 of those jobs are in rural communities. We're also at a point in our industry where we are getting acclaim and third-party write-ups for our wines that we've never had before, and at a time when we have more of those wines now to take to market. The Oregon wine industry continues to be a primary driver as our state's economy rebalances from, you know, various natural resource businesses towards more value-added agritourism and agriculture. We've seen tremendous growth in the Oregon wine business. As I mentioned, over 700 wineries now in the state, 17,000 jobs in total. We have 1,000 growers providing fruit to those 700 wineries. And we also now generate economic activity in every one of Oregon's 36 counties. That equals over $500 million in wages attributable to our industry, and we pay $65 million in annual property taxes. About 70% of our wineries are family-owned small wineries, representing production of about 5,000 cases or less. And as you just heard Senator Winter say, those will be some of the primary beneficiaries of this additional infusion of funding to help them expand distribution across the marketplace. We're quite fortunate also in this business right now with Oregon Wine to be at a point where the state's wine industry has simply never been making as much consistently good wine and excellently rated wine as it is right now. Over the last few days, we've been hosting 270 fine wine buyers and restaurant buyers from around the state at an event called the Oregon Pinot Camp, and they are here to learn more about Oregon and go out and evangelize for it. And that kind of spending, the kind of spending we're talking about in today's measure, will allow us to do that with more frequency and with even greater reach. The other point, couple points I want to touch on real quick before inviting your questions is specifically around quality. We're quite unique in the agricultural sector in that our wines and our products are written up in magazines and published for consumers around the world to read. I'm always amused when I talk to my colleagues in the blueberry or the hazelnut or the grass seed business. They don't deal with anything like magazines that are held up and sold by retailers and read by restaurateurs all around the country that rate their products on 100-point scales. What's unique about Oregon is that not only are we a relatively small part of the wine equation, as Senator Winters mentioned, we're about 1.5% of the American wine sold. But when the editors at Wine Spectator magazine, our industry's number one magazine domestically, when they published their review of all the wines that had been rated 90 or higher on their 100-point scale, Little Oregon, with a 1.5% market share, had 20% of those most highly rated wines. In fact, they publish another edition called the Top 100. Once a year, they look at all the top 100 wines from anywhere in the world, and you would expect Oregon to have maybe one or two on that list. Oregon had five. And for the first time ever, Oregon had two out of the top three 100 wines in the world.
Can you name those five?
Those five are, I have them listed right here, but one is called Domaine Serene, one is called Beaufrère, one is called Nicholas J., and the other two, I'm going to have to consult my magazine, and I'm happy to do that and fill you in right after. Would that be acceptable, Co-Chair?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Quite unique. In fact, we, with a wine industry that is about one-third the size of our colleagues to the north in Washington State, we had more wines on this list. We continue to generate more interest from outside investors and winemakers than some of our colleagues around the country. So it's a really great time for us to be considering opportunities to invest in our wine business and the job-creating engine that it is. And I would also make sure to make the committee members aware that beyond just the jobs directly attributable to wine, our wine industry is quite unique in the multiplier effects that it can have on the state's tourism business. We're very fortunate to have tremendous partners at Travel Oregon and throughout the state in local regional destination marketing organizations who partner with our wineries to make the most of the wine tourism opportunity. Just to put some scale and dimension around the tourism opportunity specific to wine in Oregon, it is currently generating 1.3 million visitor nights per year, specifically attributable to wine tourism. It's a quarter of $1 billion annually in wine tourism. We want to continue to fuel that. That generates jobs even beyond the ones that are directly related to our industry. The critical marketing need now is to enhance and extend the reach, frequency, and impact of our distribution, marketing, and promotional programs. And these efforts must target the prospective wine consumers. We want to encourage even more tourism than we're getting already in Oregon, and we want to continue to encourage ongoing purchase when those tourists return home. Senate Bill 316 with the proposed dashed A4 amendments would allocate $500,000. To create new worldwide market access opportunities for Oregon wineries and enhance the research and development efforts that will continue to keep our wines at the top of the market. It's important to also note that the money we're talking about today is only about one-sixth of the amount that the industry will invest itself over the coming biennium through a tax that it's had in place over three decades of $25 per ton that's legislated and is assessed on the industry. The funds we're talking about today will be directed to the Wine Board to implement the marketing and market access and research investment strategy. It will help us increase U.S. and global market penetration. It will help continue to stimulate Oregon food and wine tourism, and it will fund important scientific research helpful to growers all over the state as they deal with climate change. The Oregon Wine Board would ensure that these new Marist programs would be in collaboration with efforts of other stakeholder partners throughout the state. It's our hope that these Marist funds can be leveraged, can also leverage other federal matching dollars and economic development grants through the U.S. Commerce Department. We're asking your vote today to send Senate Bill 316 to the Full Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Gomberg. We're happy to take questions.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any questions?
I do.
Representative Nierman.
So I have a bunch of wineries in my district, too, so I appreciate that contribution. And it's my understanding that this money, it's not general fund money, but it's going to end up displacing general fund money because it's money that would go to the general fund but doesn't. And so when you hold up the wine tasting magazine like that, to me that almost argues against your case. And you say, oh, the grass seed people, they wish they had this magazine or whatever. I'm saying, well, maybe we should go promote the grass seed industry. I have a lot of grass seed in my district, too. I guess they kind of tend to be neighbors of wineries and everything. So it worries me about this money here. So how many wineries are there in Oregon, and how many of them pay this tax, pay the tax that supports this?
Sure. There are 702 wineries around the state, Representative Nierman, and they are all subject. Every winery and every grower in Oregon is subject to the tax collected by OLCC on grape production.
But there's a, if I can follow, please.
Follow.
There's an exemption of the first 40,000 gallons or barrels.
Correct. There are two components to the tax equation for any wine business in Oregon. One is non-negotiable. It is $25 per ton on every ton grown and crushed in Oregon. The second component you're talking about is called the privilege tax, and that is subject on, is levied on any winery once they exceed 40,000 gallons in production.
How many wineries pay that?
There are approximately, last time we got some data from OLCC, there were about 200 wineries in Oregon that are currently not subject to the small producer exemption, and about 200 of our 700. So the vast majority are small producers.
That pay the tax or that get the exemption?
About 200 pay the tax out of 700 total wineries.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Can I follow up?
This tax has been in place for about 40 years now, and I would think that the wine industry would have kind of evolved and changed a little bit over 40 years. Has there been any kind of analysis of this tax and the exemptions and whether or not it's hitting the industry fairly or anything like that?
Well, we continue to look at our funding streams and talk with our industry. I think what's important to acknowledge is that the measure before you today is, as I touched on, is dealing with an amount of money that is only about one-sixth what the industry will invest in itself through those tonnage taxes. So it's a relatively small proportion. As far as analyzing the spending of the industry is already generating the tax money that I talked about. It also is investing in itself through things like the Oregon Pinot Camp, through many, many other programs that are done regionally that aren't even done by the Oregon Wine Board, but that benefit the industry. So there are many levels of support that the industry generates for itself. But you raised an excellent point, Representative Nierman, when you kind of questioned my use of this and maybe perhaps wondering, is that the best use of this money when we're getting this kind of acclaim already, which I think was the nature of your question.
Yeah, that's exactly
it's
right.
Actually just the absolute right time to be investing in our business. We continue to hear when we do our consumer research and talk to people around the country, the two primary barriers that Oregon wineries encounter when faced with wanting to increase sales are consumers telling us, I don't know very much yet about Oregon, and the wines aren't widely available where I buy wine. Those are market penetration issues that the funding we're talking about today is meant to address. And I only cite these examples as saying, one would be, you would be investing in a business that has product quality that is recognized around the world. That's a great thing to invest in. In fact, we're the envy of the American wine business right now here in Oregon. It's why outside capital is coming here. is because of the quality of the wine. It just needs to get into more consumers' hands.
Sure, and I believe that to be the case.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Other questions? I have a couple. Today we're going to be talking with the committee as we conclude. We brought little committee presents. They celebrate the bounty of our oceans and our superior cheese. I'm just wondering, with fish people paying landings, why is it that we shouldn't be celebrating all of these? And when we celebrate all of these, the price becomes prohibitive. What distinguishes wine from the bounty of our oceans and our fields that also has world-class cachet?
Well, I wouldn't, Co-Chair Johnson, I wouldn't criticize anything that's going on in the seafood or salmon business. In fact, when we go to market and do wine tastings, we are often bringing some of those Oregon products with us and putting them on display. We would absolutely love to see them get the support that they deserve. I can't speak to all the internals of their industry, but as I said, the wine business right now is a 17,000 job generating machine touching every single county. And we are happy to partner with other product categories, including the seafood, when we go and promote Oregon wine.
Okay, you're blazing into my second question. With 17,000 employees and 700 wineries, how do you propose to have equitable distribution of this money in terms of marketing? Senator Winter spoke specifically to individual businesses. How are we assured that you're not going to just cream off the big guys that are the award winners and promote them and leave mom and pop better grapes behind?
Excellent question, Co-Chair Johnson. Thank you for that. We're quite fortunate in our industry to have several strong regional association partners, the Southern Oregon Winery Association or the Columbia Gorge Winery Association. Our spending and programming development would be in concert with those. Those organizations have membership that bubbles up from all of their regions. So while we couldn't perhaps address the unique needs of each individual business, by working closely with our regional partners and, again, the regional travel partners that help promote tourism in those areas, we will be touching the major regions of the state and, as a result, touching many of the wineries based in those diverse regions.
And my last question is, what are your sideboards on the ads that are developed to ensure that the quality of the ads and the quality of the ad placement or your promotional materials is commensurate with the quality of the wine?
I'm sorry, Co-Chair. Can you be a little more specific?
Who's going to do your ads, and how do you know they're high quality and placed well?
Well, we're quite fortunate to have an industry marketing committee at the Oregon Wine Board made up of representatives of all over the state, and they're historically not shy at all about telling us when they see something that isn't quite right. I will also say that the majority of the effort that we're talking about being funded by the money we're talking about today will primarily be used in tastings and education events, getting more restaurateurs involved and interested and aware of Oregon wine, getting more importers and distributors. There will be relatively focused and relatively little broad-scale advertising. Our primary effort will be focused on getting the key influencers in our category, those who sell fine wine, to address those two issues I mentioned, knowledge of Oregon wine and availability of Oregon wine.
Thank you. Colleagues, any other questions for this gentleman? Senator Hansel.
Yes, if I may. My question is, and maybe it was considered not accepted, but why isn't there some kind of additional self-assessment that the wine industry that seems to be really booming right now from your testimony, why isn't there additional to do the promotion you're talking about? I understand other commodity groups, such as what Senator Johnson has done, the Wheat League, there's a per bushel assessment, et cetera. I'm just struggling a little bit that $500,000 in these tough budget times, where we've had to cut education, health care, other things, I've got to go home to my folks and say, you know, we cut out these programs, but we gave $500,000 to promote wine. Can you help me a little bit?
Sure. It's a great question, Senator Hansel. I think it speaks to perhaps a couple of things. We're not naive to the budget issues. No one in our community is naive to the budget issues that the state is dealing with. We live in these communities, too. It is, however, again, a small portion of what the industry is already investing in itself. You ask a question about, are there other assessments the industry could absorb to fund some of this efforts? The conference that I just mentioned, where 270 wine professionals from around the country are here right now for a thing called Oregon Pinot Camp, there is an industry assessment that funds that. There is an industry assessment that will also fund the Southern Oregon Wine Experience in August that will take place in Southern Oregon that will bring decision makers from around the country. The industry is taking those steps. And in answer to your question, there's still an opportunity, though, to address that primary concern, which is how do we get these great wines more broadly penetrated and broadly available? And our industry is investing $25 for every ton, and the amount of money that we're asking here is really just a turbocharger, again, on the jobs creation machine that the Oregon wine industry is, and the ripple effects it will have through tourism and other areas.
Well, I understand that, but why not do $30 per ton and then you don't have to come to the general fund?
It's a great question, Senator Nierman. I think the primary dynamic is that our community is made up of small family farmers. And these family farmers are, if you've read the Portland Business Journal, and if you haven't, I'm happy to provide the article. They talked in depth to Oregon family farmers around the state. And many of them are dealing with an unbelievably incredible competitive situation. We've all probably stood in a grocery store and looked at a wine assortment and almost been staggered at the amount of choice the consumer has for a small brand to break through that clutter. That's where this money will be tremendously helpful. The ability of a small family business to absorb even an additional assessment, for many, the 25 per ton is quite high. And we haven't even talked about the federal excise taxes that are levied on alcohol. The tax burden on these small family farmers is quite extreme. The special assessments for other programs not covered by the wine board that I've talked about today, those are over and above what they're paying. These are family farmers trying to generate jobs, and that's what we want to support.
Thank you very much. I'm going to move us along. I don't care what order you two ladies go in.
Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, my name is Jana McCamey, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Wine Growers Association, here in a support role to Mr. Danowski, who I think has done a thorough job of explaining our proposal and answering your questions. So I'm not going to add any more testimony other than to ask you to please vote today to pass Senate Bill 316 to the full Ways and Means Committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of this witness? Thank you very much, Ms. Squires.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires today. Here on behalf of Wine Institute, which is a public policy association, which represents 834 California wineries of all sizes. As Representative Nierman has pointed out, the Oregon statutes enacted in 1977 do provide for exemption from the wine privilege tax for the first 40,000 gallons of wine that is produced. I think our data differs from Tom's a little bit, that we estimate that only 50 of Oregon's 700 wineries actually do pay the wine excise privilege tax. And in addition to that, in 1983, statutes were enacted that added a 2-cent wine excise tax that was directly dedicated to Tom's board, and that money flows straight through to Tom's board. And so most of the 2 cents comes from out-of-state wineries. So as a result, our association opposed Senate Bill 316A as it moved from the Senate Business Committee, based upon the fact that we believe that it furthered what we believe to be discrimination against out-of-state wineries, but with a -4 amendment and the revision that unties the additional appropriation from the wine tax by making it just a straight general fund appropriation, we have no objections to the bill with a -4.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any questions of Ms. Squire? Representative Reardon.
Did I understand? Oh, thank you, Co-Chair. Did I understand correctly that the smaller farmers or producers are exempted from this tax, so they're somehow protected in this fundraising scheme?
Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Reardon, as Tom indicated, there are two different provisions in play here. There's a wine excise tax, and the first 40,000 gallons of wine produced in Oregon is exempt from that wine excise tax. There's also a $25 per ton assessment that is imposed, and that applies to all wineries.
Okay. Thank you.
That was responsive. You're okay?
That's fine.
Okay. Good. Colleagues, any other questions? Thank you very much. Before the sign-in sheet was gathered up, anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 316 that we've missed? All right, they're seeing none. Ms. Dyster?
Okay. The Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending adoption of the -A4 amendment to Senate Bill 316A.
Co-Chair Johnson, I would move adoption of the -A4 amendments.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Any questions?
Exactly what does it do?
Co-Chairs, Senator Monroe, the -A4 amendment provides general fund in the amount of $500,000 for the activities outlined in this bill on a one-time basis. There's a sunset provision that's also included for the enhancement program that's established by the bill.
Can I speak to the motion?
Senator Monroe.
I have been a big supporter of the Oregon wine industry, both personally and legislatively, all my career. In fact, when I take a cruise with my wife or go somewhere in Europe, I always ask them if they have Oregon wines. And if they say no, then I say, why not? Because it's the best in the world. So I'm a big supporter. The problem is I also write the education budgets. And I've been cutting early childhood. I've been cutting K-12. I've been cutting college and universities and putting out budgets that are inadequate. And if I vote for this, I'm saying this is a better place to put this $500,000 of general fund than in some of those education budgets that I had to cut, and I simply can't do that.
Thank you. Representative Reardon.
Thank you, Co-Chair. This is really difficult because I, like Senator Winter said, I'm, you know, very proud of the growth of this industry. It's been a phenomenal success story for Oregon. And, you know, I support Oregon wines, and I enjoy Oregon wines very much. But like Senator Monroe said, this is like $500,000 I would be embarrassed to vote for. I feel we are in such tight, difficult times, and I'm not going to go back to my district, which has a school district with 80% of the kids on free and reduced lunch, and tell them the wine board is more important than those kids. I cannot do that. I cannot go back to my district where I've got people camping out on the streets every evening and not being supported, and they come in here and asking for $500,000. It just is very upsetting. I am sorry. I love the wine industry. I cannot support this at all.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, we're going to stand at ease for just a moment. And colleagues, we're coming out of recess, and this was a consultation to see whether or not we needed to invite the co-chairs or the presiding officers down to help us today. and so we're prepared to go ahead. There may be some courtesy votes today, and I want to make sure that everyone who wishes to speak on the bill has the opportunity to do so. I see Representative Meek. And so I think we'll take a motion first, and then we'll take some discussion. So, Ms. Deister, I think you've made your explanation, so the chair now awaits a motion.
And I'm sorry, have we already considered the Dash 4 amendments?
No.
No.
And I thought I had moved that, but I'll try again. I move adoption of the Dash A4 amendments to Senate Bill 316.
Okay, and the Dash, that was where we took up on the discussion that laid out that these were one-time only, and the dollar amounted to $500,000. And so we have a motion to amend the Dash 4s into Senate Bill 316. Any questions, any discussion? Representative Meek, did you have...
I can speak to the full...
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Any other discussion? Any objections? Senator Monroe is an objection. Representative Nierman is an objection. Okay. So we now adopt the Dash 4s into Senate Bill 316.
And Co-Chair, I would move...
I'm objecting as well.
Oh.
Okay, so we'll note that Representative Reardon is also an objection to the Dash 4 amendments.
Right. Thank you. I didn't mean to rush that, Co-Chair. I would move Senate Bill 316 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, colleagues. You have heard the motion. Any questions? Any discussion? Whoops, we got a question.
No, I'm sorry.
Okay, any discussion? Representative Meek.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Colleagues, I am a courtesy yes vote on this today. And the reason why is because, well, the reason why I'm a courtesy, I would strongly be a no. And the reason why is because we find ourselves in a deficit. And I, like my good friend, Representative Reardon here, cannot find in good conscience vote for a $500,000 subsidy to a thriving business, which clearly was stated that we have, you know, top-notch worldwide wine out there that can't support themselves. But we have families out there that are going through foreclosures right now, and we're going to cut that whole program, or the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Program, while hundreds of families are going to be in peril of losing their home. And so I find it very difficult, and I do think that I would support increasing the wine tax to augment the work that the Oregon Wine Board is doing, and you guys continue to do the great work on behalf of the industry, and considering the explosive growth in the wine industry we've seen over the past 15 years, I believe the Wine Board will be doing a great job and service for their industry. I will be a courtesy yes, but otherwise.
Senator Hansel, then I'll come back to you. Representative Noble.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. If needed, I will be a courtesy yes to move it forward. What my colleague, Representative Reardon, so eloquently stated, I feel the same way. It's just difficult for me to go back. And we have a burgeoning and well-developed, and I've supported as a county commissioner on getting it started, and now as a state senator, our wine industry in our area, it's doing great. I'm supportive of it, but to take general fund dollars in this budget situation right now, I just am unable to do it. But if need be, I will be a courtesy.
Thank
yes.
you, Representative Noble.
Thank you, Co-Chair. First, I live in a district where most of those vineyards and most of those wineries are. And it's not a large district. They're small farms. They're small operations. My lens, what I see this, I think we have what is normally, when people think about the wine industry, we think about maybe a different socioeconomic class. We think of wine glasses. We don't think of, as in the grass seed industry, we don't look at where we see hay balers. And I know when I drive through my district, we're talking about small farms. We're not talking about large corporate operations, although they exist in Oregon. But in my district, we're talking about Mr. and Mrs. Smith with a few employees, and we're talking over a couple hundred of those in my district.
was talking about small farming operations. And the only difference between that and grass seed is, or filberts, is what's coming out of the ground. I'm going to try to be statesmanlike. The irony in that here we're pitting economic growth and development against children, and I do see that. And I've sat on committees where we talk about project independence, and we had a large debate on the floor where we talked about ready-to-read programs. But I think we're having this debate here because the larger group in this building here has been able to come up with spending reform. So we're now pitting economic growth and development, specifically in my district and around the rest of the county and the state, against children. And I have to be honest, I'm offended at that. I understand the dialogue. Yes, half of this money would bring back ready to read, and I think that's a very honorable thing. But we're here debating these two things simply because we failed at the larger issue. And I think I'll just leave it at that. I vote yes.
Representative Gomberg.
Oh, thank you, Co-Chair. Unlike Representative Noble, I don't have a lot of wineries in my district, maybe a handful, certainly none west of my district. But I'm not unfamiliar with the wine industry. In fact, having spent some time over 30 years ago plowing ground that eventually became a fine winery just south of Salem. And I was one of those employees that found an opportunity to help me get through the summer. And now we're talking about a thriving industry, and we're talking about remarkable growth. But colleagues, I am convinced that that while we have seen success and we have seen growth, that we haven't begun to reach our potential yet. We haven't begun to reach our potential yet. And I am not unsympathetic to the conversation we're having here today when we're looking at the challenges for funding our schools, our senior programs, our transportation programs, certainly our housing challenges right now. And those are not inconsequential questions. But part of that conversation has to be, how do we get out of the situation where we've got problems with schools, problems with housing, problems with seniors? And I can't tell you how many times on the floor of the House I've heard the statement that before we talk about increasing taxes and before we start talking about cutting costs, we need to talk about growing the economy. I've heard that outline on the floor of the House. I'm not convinced that this is the very best proposal we've got before us to grow the economy. But nor am I convinced it's the worst proposal before us. I think this is a tool to help us grow the economy and grow our way out of some of the challenges we're facing, in spite of the fact that we've got to make these horribly awful decisions about schools and housing and seniors and economic growth. So I'll be a yes on this one, Co-Chair Johnson.
Thank you. Representative Nierman.
Thank you. I'll be quick here. I have kind of a more philosophical objection. I don't mind that the money's spent, and I won't pit it against children or housing or anything like that, and I'm sure you guys could come up with good ways to spend the money. But I have an objection to that this is tax money that's collected and then used to support an industry. And I think a paradigm for this, maybe run a little bit amok, is the Oregon Forest Industries Council, which has been a little bit of a kind of a crony operation as far as I can see. So I object to it on that grounds. I think I would be very happy with the exact same dollar amounts being spent if the industry would just take it out of its profits and dedicate it to itself and promote itself that way. So that's my objection.
Thank you, colleagues. All right, everyone has had an opportunity to speak. We have a motion before us. I am going to ask for objections. I think for the record, I would be noted as a courtesy yes today. I want the opportunity to, frankly, further educate myself on this bill. I came into the room as a yes, and the discussion has been very provocative. So,
no.
Okay, so we have objections, please. Representative Nierman, Representative Reardon, and on the Senate side, Senator Monroe. And I think she's got those. Motion carries, and we will now need to assign carriers. Representative Noble on the House, and we need to full and the Senate. And tonight.
I would imagine Senator Winters would want
what
to take this.
What a good idea to full and to the Senate. What a great idea. All right, so we have our carriers. I'm going to close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 316, and I am going to open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2002A relating to preservation of housing, and ask Ms. Deister to introduce the subject.
I do see Kenny Geyer here.
Yeah. And, Representative, would you like to testify before the professional staff introduces it?
I would.
Please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Representative Alyssa Kinnegar from House District 46, parts of Southeast Northeast Portland. I know you've had a really long hearing, and you will yet ahead of you, so I'll just keep it very brief now that we've got three people behind me who are going to go into more detail about it. But I just want to say that preservation is one of the most important things. We've got a lot of things on the housing agenda to try to move the needle on our housing crisis, and preservation, which is preserving affordable units, is one of the most crucial. It's also one of the ones that garners the most unanimous support. You know that when we talk about building new units, that can come into controversy for a number of reasons. But when you talk about preserving the housing that's out there that people currently have, that we have already put public subsidies into, whether it's through HUD at the federal level or through the Rural Development Program of USDA or through local investments, These are units that we have already invested in, and it's really critical that we're able to maintain that. We also know that on average, the cost of maintaining an affordable unit through preservation is about two-thirds the cost of creating a new one. And beyond that, there's just the social implication of if we lose those, you've got people who've been living in those units, and it's not just a roof over their head. It's not just that people often who are elderly or disabled are going to have to leave and find some other kind of housing, which is really hard when you're fragile, but they've also created community. So that social cohesion would be lost as well. So this is one of the most important pieces of the housing puzzle, the affordable housing puzzle. And when we had the audit of Oregon Housing Community Services done last year, it is one of the most glaring things that surfaced was the lack of capacity that the agency had. And I know several members here, I'm sorry, Representative Meekleff, but three of the members on your committee are on the Human Services and Housing Committee. And so we heard that they were deplorable in their capacity to understand what are the units that are coming up for renewal. And at the point, we need to be able to project that and get the financing packaging in place, not only to acquire the unit, but also to rehabilitate it, because often it's not been well maintained over a 20 or 30 year period. So that was the number one thing that I read out of that audit, and I have asked my staff to put that audit on OLIS for your benefit. But we need to build up the capacity. It's about $500,000 a year. You'll get more detail about that, in order to have the database, have several people, have outreach, be able to put the packages together so that we can maintain these. Of course, there's also a complimentary request, as we have every year, in out of the lottery bonds to actually put preservation dollars. So this bill itself is to build the capacity at the agency to really know what are our needs and how we're going to proactively meet those needs. So if there's not any other questions, I just want to again highlight this is one of the most critical pieces coming out of our committee.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions of Representative Kinnegar? Are you going to stay for the rest of the hearing?
I can if you'd like.
Well, let me just make my comment now. I have had the opportunity to speak on a number of occasions with Director Salazar about an emphasis on preservation. I think frequently we have seen the bright, shiny bubble of build new. And I went to the groundbreaking of an older, probably 35-year-old facility in Scappoose that was lovingly restored. It kept most of the tenants, mostly elderly women, in situ while the restoration occurred. It is, in fact, a community, as you describe it. And the restorative efforts in this old building have probably given it another 30 years of practical life, with step-in showers, with beautifully appointed kitchens, hardwood floors in some places, and maintained the continuity of the community, as well as keeping that stock in inventory. My point is, I have been very pleased to hear Ms. Salazar say that there will be an emphasis in the agency on preservation, not just racing out and building new at considerably higher expense.
Well, thank you. As usual, Madam Co-Chair, you say it better than I or anyone else. You have a real gift of words, and I know how hard you work in your own community and watch those things unfold. And I just want to say also that what is the point of our doing audits unless we respond? So this is the response that the legislature can take from a really glaring deficiency that we've had to date in the agency. So I'm really pleased to support this here.
Thank you very much. I know you're busy. Colleagues, I am going to invite up the next people that have signed, Ms. Salazar, the Director of the Housing and Community Services, and Mr. Prash. And recognizing that we've got until quarter after to get this bill concluded, we've got one more work session. I would very much like a description from Ms. Deister on how this bill has changed from its first iteration.
I saved what I was going to say for Taylor, since she was able to come after all. Can she come up and join us?
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to start with the professional staff and then ask you all to respond to it and offer your testimony. Ms. Deister.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, House Bill 2002 provides for notice to local government and to the Housing and Community Services Department when a property with an expiring or terminating affordability contract is withdrawn. It gives the Housing and Community Services Department and local governments notice prior to the property being made available for sale. First right of refusal is provided to Housing and Community Services, local governments, or a designee when a property owner accepts a third party's offer of sale, which that right of refusal would allow for an opportunity to match or exceed an offer in an effort to maintain the property as affordable housing inventory. The Housing and Community Services Department is required under the bill to maintain a database with information from state, local, and federal sources concerning the status of existing affordability restrictions, rental contracts, and participating properties on which notice of sale has been given.
And I understand what was stricken out was the need for the property owner to pay relocation. Is that correct?
Members of the subcommittee, Madam Co-Chair, you have two amendments before you today. One is the -A3 amendment that removes the requirement that the owner of a participating property pay a fee or relocation costs of tenants. And then there's the -A5 amendment, which appropriates funding to support the agency's expenditures related to implementing the measure.
Thank you very kindly. Ms. Salazar, welcome.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I am honored to speak to you today about the issue of affordable housing preservation. I want to provide you with some background on the issue and some information about how House Bill 2002 will support critical preservation work needed throughout our state. I just have to say this issue is near and dear to my heart. In fact, it has been the focus of my work for the past decade, first at the national level at HUD, and now here at the state level. While we recognize the need to develop new affordable housing and how critical that is to help fill the rental housing gap, we also know that preservation must be a key component of an effective housing strategy. We estimate nationally that for every one affordable home being developed, we are at risk of losing three, either to disrepair or conversion to market rate use. In the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, the federal government financed the construction of thousands of affordable properties across the nation, including here in Oregon. These properties were financed with loans and loan guarantees from HUD and USDA Rural Development. Another portfolio of federal properties is the public housing stock, which is managed by public housing authorities and overseen by HUD. In addition to these federally assisted properties, we also have a portfolio of properties funded by the state of Oregon through our agency and an array of local affordable housing programs. Many of these properties are also aging and have the same risks as the federal stock. Today, these properties are 30, 40, or even 50 plus years old, and they have significant needs and risks.
Ms. Salazar, some of us take exception to your characterization of 50 as being ancient. Please move ahead.
From a property management standpoint, Co-Chair, it has a little bit different connotation. These properties have significant repair needs. Many of them have not undergone any substantial rehabilitation over several decades. They have major systems needs, systems improvements. Seismic upgrades, as we know, is critical. energy efficiency needs. These properties tend to need energy efficiency upgrades and are just really bleeding energy because they have not had those kinds of retrofits that are so critical. Many of them need improvements for accessibility for persons with disabilities. In fact, they may have been constructed before the Americans with Disabilities Act or fair housing requirements regarding accessibility. We also know that many of the residents of these properties are advancing in age, and we need repairs to help seniors be able to age in place and, as we spoke of so eloquently, be able to maintain residency as part of a community. And finally, one of the biggest risks is the expiring rental assistance contracts and expiring use agreements. These properties are owned by nonprofit organizations or, in some cases, for-profit organizations that are mission-oriented, but they are not compelled to retain the affordability after the original use agreements and rental assistance contracts expire. When those contracts expire, they have the ability to convert to market rates. And in some of our overheated markets, that is a significant risk. So we're at risk of losing these properties not only to the physical and capital needs, but also the fact that they are at risk of being converted to another use other than affordable housing. So at OHCS, we are a steward of hundreds of affordable properties that we have supported through the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program and other state investments. There is a growing recognition that in addition to the federal stock, our state-funded portfolio also needs attention as those properties begin to age and incur a number of those same risks. And that's one of the reasons why our agency has begun to engage more deeply in the conversation around preservation. We are working to develop a statewide affordable housing inventory that will include not only our state-financed portfolio, but also those properties that are funded by local jurisdictions, as well as those federal properties located across the state. We are right now in the initial stages of building that database, but it will need care and feeding to remain successful over the long term. As you heard Representative Kenny Guyer mention, a recent Secretary of State performance audit highlighted the need for our agency to do more on the issue of affordable housing preservation. The audit found that, in fact, that stock is at great risk because of our agency's lack of strategy and strategic investment around the issue of preservation over the past. HB 2002 will provide the essential program and policy structure to guide our preservation strategy for the agency. The bill includes a modest investment in staffing and resources to help our agency to further develop that statewide affordable housing inventory so that we can understand where to best target our resources, and a concerted program to ensure that affordable multifamily housing remains a resource for Oregonians statewide. I want to thank Speaker Kotek for her leadership on this issue. I also recognize the leadership of Representative Kenny Guyer, and I'll certainly recognize the work of Taylor Smiley-Wolf, who you'll be hearing from in a few moments, as well as the insight provided by our partners across the state, including Rob Prash, who is here from the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. Thank you very much
for the
opportunity.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, questions of Ms. Salazar? Let's hear from the rest of the witnesses, and then I have one for you, Madam Director. Mr. Prash.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rob Prash. I'm the Preservation Director with the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. My career in affordable housing started in 1991 when I was named the Preservation Program Coordinator at the Oregon HUD office. And like Margaret Salazar, much of my time in affordable housing has been spent focused on preservation. Margaret did a great job already describing the history of the federal government's investments in subsidized housing and the risks to Oregon's portfolio, so I'm not going to touch on that, but I do want to emphasize something that Margaret brought up in her comments. The first and most important element of a comprehensive statewide preservation strategy is knowing your inventory and being able to assess the risks to it. And unless you have that critical information, your preservation strategies will not be as effective as they need to be. When the Oregon Housing Preservation Project was created in 2007, one of the first things we accomplished was building a statewide inventory of Oregon's federally subsidized housing. And having that information allowed us to track contract expirations, respond to opt-out notices, and match potential buyers with sellers who are willing to preserve that property. HB 2002 will provide critical information that we believe will help preserve many other types of affordable housing, including tens of thousands of the units developed under the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program, which is by far the state's largest inventory of affordable housing. And in just a few short years, those older tax credit projects will start coming to the end of their 30-year restricted use period. And the fact is, we simply don't know how many of those projects will convert to market when they come to the end of those restrictions. HB 2002 will expand current notice requirements so that state and local government is notified when a publicly supported housing project in their jurisdiction is expiring or may soon exit an affordable housing program. And that notice will allow those entities to take actions to try to preserve those properties in that much-needed housing. So I'm going to turn it over to Taylor, but I also want to thank Speaker Kotek for her leadership and Representative Kenny Geyer as well. And thank you all for considering this important legislation.
Thank you very much. Questions of this witness? Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Gomberg. Thank you so much for having me today. For the record, my name is Taylor Smiley-Wolf. I'm here on behalf of Speaker Kotek. I was going to do a high-level overview of the bill, but staff did such an incredible job that I just wanted to add one small clarification about the Dash A3 amendments that are in front of you today. So the A3 amendments remove a provision in the bill that would have allowed OHCS and a local government to require relocation for tenants in the case where that wasn't currently in the contract. So the reason that we're removing that is because OHCS and a local government have the ability to negotiate that in contracts, and many contracts already have that language. So we decided to remove that from the bill to avoid an opportunity to require relocation if it hadn't already been required in the contract. So that's why it's being removed, and I'm happy to take questions if you have any. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, questions of this panel? Senator Hansel.
Just a couple of quick questions. When it converts to market, is there a period of time from construction till they're able to exercise that option? You said that we don't know those that are going to convert out of that.
The term of the use agreement associated with the project is tied to the program under which that project was originally developed, and there are dozens of such programs. So I can't really answer your question, but the most common term is about 30 years.
Do we have any follow-up? Do we have any kind of data here in Oregon or elsewhere that would indicate or share how many of those units, when they do reach end of the life, do actually convert to market?
Co-chairs, Senator Hansel, we in my company, Network for Oregon Affordable Housing, we've managed the Oregon Housing Preservation Project since 2007, and we've worked with the agencies, both state agencies and the federal government agencies that run these housing programs, to track those contract expiration dates, the extensions of those, to predict when a project might exit, and to try to intervene and extend those contracts where possible.
But my question is, do we have data? How many off that way? Maybe.
And there is data. Unfortunately, it's not available in any one place. So what we've done is we've gone to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. We've gone to USDA Rural Development. We've gone to OHCS. We've gone to the cities. It's a difficult thing to compile all that and maintain it and keep refreshing that data.
Mm-hmm. And Senator and co-chairs, if I may add another component, I think part of the question was, how often do properties end up converting to market? Is that a real threat? Is that a real concern? There was a significant national study done by HUD's Office of Policy Development and Research in the early 2000s, looking at the incidence of opt-outs. And what it found was that there was a significant influx when markets become more hot, more attractive. You do see owners exercising their opportunity to opt out. And we can certainly find that study and provide that to all of you to make sure that you all have that background information.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I know we're running out of time. So I don't think I've heard anything about what actually happens to the folks that are living in a project. Construction is pretty disruptive, so are they temporarily relocated and then go back? Because Rep. Kenegar talked about maintaining community, so how does that work?
Representative Reardon and co-chairs, the decision about the temporary relocation of residents really varies from project to project based on how much rehab is needed.
So in some cases, you may only need moderate or minor repairs to be able to preserve the long-term viability of a project. In some cases, you may need to do significant gut rehab. But there are protections for residents that they can't be permanently and involuntarily displaced during the rehab. So they do receive those protections under current state and federal rules.
Great.
Thank you. And my comment is, I hope you use the term bleeding energy. I hope that you will turn to the Energy Trust of Oregon to find subsidization for some of those repairs. All right. Thank you, panel, very much. Co-Chair Gomberg.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I move adoption of the -A3 amendments to House Bill 2002.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Any questions, any discussion, any objections? They are adopted. Co-Chair Gomberg.
I then move adoption of the -A5 amendments.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Any questions, any discussion, any objection? Representative Reardon, before I hit the gavel, you want to say something?
It seemed like $500,000 well spent.
All right.
May I, just for clarification, the actual amount is $453,320.
Even better.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the we need the final motion.
We do indeed, Madam Co-Chair. But as I understand it, when there's two amendments, they'll be consolidated for
the
full.
Yes,
so
they will.
To avoid any confusion, there will only be one amendment when this gets to full. But I move House Bill 2002 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Any questions, any discussion, any objections? So ordered. We need carriers. I'm going to
I would love to carry it.
We've got a volunteer to go to full and the Senate, and I think out of respect for Representative Kenny Geyer that we will volunteer her in her absence. Any objections to that? Okay. So I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2002. We've got our carriers, and thank you very much. This next one should take 6 seconds. Ms. Dyster, before you go, on behalf of a very grateful committee, thank you for all of your service to us.
You'll see me tomorrow.
I know we're going to see you again tomorrow. But it's your job to keep the cheese cold now, not mine.
So, Madam Co-Chair, just a quick correction. This next bill should take 6 more seconds.
6 more seconds. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. Your next item is Senate Bill 256, which is scheduled for a work session, establishes a 23-member commission to advise state, local, and regional government agencies on the Willamette Falls locks. The new recommended amendment online is the -6, which appropriates $190,000 general fund to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to be distributed to the Oregon Solutions of Portland State University. The amendment provides whereas language related to the history of the Willamette Falls, and it includes whereas clauses for both the Columbia River tribes and the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde Community of Oregon.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 256. You have heard the professional staff's recommendation. I'm looking out in the audience. We've got a deal that's still holding here. A thumbs up all the way around. Chair Gomberg, I would entertain motions.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I am very pleased to move adoption of the -A6 amendments to Senate Bill 256.
Colleagues, you have heard the motion. Any questions? Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Excuse me, a correction. I just want to make sure I stated that correctly, Co-Chair. It's not the A6, it's the -6 amendments. And that's what I'm sure you heard.
I heard the -6. And that's what the gavel signified, and we've adopted the -6. All right. We need carriers.
No, we need a full motion.
Oh, we need a full motion. Sorry. I'm so excited about getting this done.
I move Senate Bill 256 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, you have heard the motion. Any questions, Senator Hansel?
Not question, just discussion. I appreciate very much your leadership that you and other co-chair did yesterday to move this forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right, colleagues, any other discussion, any questions, any objection? So ordered.
who's gonna put this in a barrel and run it over the falls, Madam Co-Chair?
I think you just volunteered.
I'm in.
Can I suggest maybe Representative Meek? It's kind of in his district or near his district. Or
I'm good with that. I yield to Representative Meek.
We'll split the baby. Representative Meek is not on. You want to take it to full?
I can take it to full.
Well, I can take it to full. It's my tribe was involved.
Okay, have it. Let Bill have it.
All right.
Cancel to full.
I think I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair, and I'm going to have an advocate for the project rather than a representative of the tribe.
I agree.
Carry it forward. So we're going to do full and Senate with Senator Monroe, and we're going to do Representative Meek on the House side.
Do you think? Just a suggestion. Do you think Senator Devlin?
He doesn't get to pick. I get to. Monroe's doing it. All right. With that, we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 256. And colleagues, before everybody leaves, Representative Gomberg, on behalf of both of us, any comments about the committee or our gifts?
You know, Co-Chair Johnson, I think that that this group has done remarkable work this session. Remarkable work for housing, remarkable work for veterans, remarkable work for economic development. And so to recognize that, we want to give you some remarkable products from our districts. The cheese in particular, I always am fond of saying that while the creamery is in Senator Johnson's district, that the cows all come from my district. And this is the Black Label white cheddar. This is
that's like gold.
That's the good stuff. And I will remind everybody, of course, that you should keep the tuna until August, which I believe is the one and only albacore tuna month.
217.
Well, it has been a pleasure to have all of you on the committee. We're going to spend some more time together, but the cheese arrived from the creamery this morning in a cooler, and it needs to find a home in your refrigerators. We will have gifts for all of the professional staff that have helped us so ably, because we're only as good as the team in LFO, and they have been remarkably professional and capable. And so on behalf of Co-Chair Gomberg and myself, thank you for your service on TED.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a great experience.
We're adjourned.
Thank you. Cool.
Be sure.